Well, welcome everyone to the Semiotic Corner and the reading of Chris Deva. While Rembert's doing that, last time, well, the seminar series is the question, what is a text, and particularly with reference to what is a religious text. We haven't discussed too much the notion of religious text, but we have discussed the notion of a text and different approaches to it. And last week we looked at the notion of authorial intention, and we looked at phenomenology and this idea of the transcendental ego, or Husserl's notion that there's posits a necessary author of a text, and Hirsch's argument that the meaning of a text is the author's intention, and that he's made that distinction between meaning and significance. So the meaning of a text is the author's intention, but the significance might vary in time according to particular circumstances, but the meaning never changes because that's connected with author's intention. And we examined that idea, and we looked at some of the problems located with that, such as how can you identify authorial intention and meaning when actually what you've got are multiple readings of texts. And then that whole Husserlian project was really questioned by semiotics. So I always think of two kind of forces or traditions in modern Western thinking. One is the phenomenological and the other is the semiotic. And the phenomenological can be glossed as a kind of phenomenology of consciousness, which is concerned with the subject, who is the subject of history, who is the agent. In philosophy, it's a question of identity. In sociology, it becomes translated as the question of agency. But it's all really a philosophy of consciousness concerned with the subject of first-person predicates and who am I, that kind of question. And then on the other hand, there's a force, I think, stemming from Judaism and through Christianity of a concern with signs and language, which is semiotics. And I think there's a philosophy of the sign, if you like, is in tension with a philosophy of consciousness, and you can trace the history of Western thinking through that tension, I think, between a philosophy of the sign and a philosophy of consciousness. And so today we're looking at the reaction against the Husserlian project, if you like, the philosophy of consciousness, with semiotics, which is a study of signs. If phenomenology is a study of appearances to consciousness, then semiotics, I suppose semiology is another word, but it's a complex terminology. Semiology, the study of signs, and the study of the conditions of communication. So semiotics or semiology is much wider in a sense than phenomenology, because it could include all sorts of signifying systems. So an ant colony is a semiotic system in some thinkers' minds, or birds flying south for the winter is a kind of semiotic system. So it's not necessarily linked with consciousness at all. So it's the study of the conditions of communication, really. And it's from the Greek word semion, sign. And semiotics is the study of signs or language in its broadest sense. And so a semiotic system is, for example, ritual pattern, latent behaviours, cultural systems, dance, theatre, languages. All of these are regarded as semiotic systems. And so cultural studies is really focused, develops out of semiotics and is interested in these kinds of cultural productions, ritual patterns, and indeed biological, genetically rooted behaviours. Now, the origins and development, the roots of semiotics are in Western hermeneutics, Western interpretations, and some argue, like Peter Oakes particularly, that its origins are in Augustine. So he says ultimately the origins of semiotics are in biblical hermeneutics, Jewish hermeneutics, which then goes into Christianity, particularly in Augustine, because of the concern with text and the meaning of words and the meaning of the text, without much reference to the notion of a subject. So it's that Jewish tradition, he argues, was focused on the idea of the meaning of the text for a community of reception. Now, so Saussure is important in all of this development of semiotics because it's focused on language, and he had this distinction between nom and parole. I apologise if this is ABC to many of you, but I'm just kind of whiz through it quickly, perhaps. So the semiotician is attempting to make explicit the system, nom, which underlies and makes possible meaningful events, parole. So parole is diachronic, is in the time, and nom is synchronic. It's kind of at the vertical dimension, outside of time, in a sense. And so Saussure is concerned with the system as a functioning totality. So he's interested in synchronic analysis, the analysis of language as a whole, not with the historical provenance of its various elements, which is diachronic analysis. And that's Jonathan Culler's expression of Saussure's position in The Pursuit of Science. Another big philosopher who's very difficult, who I'm not going to really deal with, is Peirce, who uses the word semiotic, but he spells it in a funny way, in a different way. And he says the entire universe is perfused, a wonderful word, perfused with signs, if it is not composed entirely of signs. And his... So, he, in a sense, he Peirce... while there's Saussure in France is regarded as the founder of semiotics in many ways. Its Peirce in the States is also regarded as a parallel founder of semiotics. But in contrast to Saussure, Peirce emphasizes what he calls thirdness. So there's always a sign, what it signifies, and a third party for whom that relationship is meaningful. So you get the interpretant is always important for Saussure, which Saussure ignored. There's a whole complex terminology here: symbol, index, icon, sign. So all these different thinkers use these terms in very different ways. There's actually an excellent book published many years ago by Leach. It's a thin book called Communication...
Culture
and Communication. Yeah, you know it, yeah. And, you know, you can read that in an afternoon, but it really clarifies these different terms very well, particularly in an anthropological context.
Who wrote that?
Edmund Leach, who was an anthropologist at Cambridge. That was published about 77, 78, something like that. But generally, I would venture to say that a symbol is in this world is regarded as an arbitrary sign. Most common sorts of word that always require an interpretation. Most common is the sort of word that requires an interpretation. So there's a signifier, and a sign is a signifier and a signified, and the relationship between them is arbitrary. Unlike Sanskrit philosophers who thought that it wasn't an arbitrary connection between the signifier and the signified, but Saussure argued there was, and that's generally taken these days. So you've got different words for tree, for example, that points to the same referent. An index. So what Saussure called a sign, I think many other semioticians call a symbol.
Sorry, can I just clarify? When you said the tree, there are different many words for a tree.
Yeah.
Is the tree the symbol? And then the signs are the different words.
No. The symbol would be the sign for the tree, if you like. The word arbra, vriksha, tree, baum, all point to the same reference.
And that would be the.
The symbol is the word.
Symbolism.
Yeah. Okay. An index is a signifier connected to its signifier. So smoke is an index of fire. Is a red light, I don't know about a red light, when you stop at a red light, is that an index?
Huh.
Or a sign? I don't know. An icon is a signifier that resembles its signified in some ways, though a map. there's a wonderful short story by Borges about a mythical Chinese emperor who wants to wants an absolutely accurate map of the country, and so the map maker set to work. But the map is as large as the country itself. So, indices and icons are motivated signs. Thirdness, that's Peirce's term. Yeah, a sign is a sign of something for some community or someone. So, I don't think I'll go into all of this. Now, whizzing through all this, Russian formalists are precursors. Structuralism was very important in developing semiotics, which came out of linguistics initially, but particularly was developed in anthropology. And one of the precursors of structuralism were the Russian formalists, who tried to develop the scientific study of poetic language, which contains its own devices and structures of expression, thereby moving away from psychological and historical studies. So they said there are deep structures, if you like, in poetry and in language, which you can study through structuralism, through unravelling the structures implicit within them. And Vladimir Propp is particularly important in all of this. He wrote an important article that you should read at some point called The Morphology of the Folktale. That's a translation, anyway. And he makes this distinction between plot, or fibula, which is non-chronological sequence, and story, which is chronological sequence. So the plot, or the fibula, is the structure, if you like, that you're trying to underline, trying to unravel through through structural analysis, or formal analysis. So this maps onto the norm-parallel distinction. And he said that narratives can be broken down into analysable units, or what he calls morphemes. And he broke down the fairy tale into 31 functions, the 31 functions of the fairy tale. So the hero's departure, that idea of the hero goes away, and there's a transformation occurs, and then the hero returns, and all these themes that you're probably familiar with. Which also influences people like Joseph Campbell, and the Hero of the Thousand Faces and all of that. So Vladimir Propp is an important figure in all of this. Perhaps more important is Mikhail Bakhtin, who responds to formalism and reacts against it, rejects its ahistoricity in that looking at the structures rather than the narrative dimension embedded within historical frame. And he particularly articulates his ideas in Tools of Philosophy of the Act, which is a really revolutionary book, and in Literary Criticism, and particularly Problems of Dostoevsky's Poetics. He died about 1975-76, but he survived the Stalinist purges amazingly. He was there's a few photographs of him. All he used to do is drink tea and smoke cigarettes all the time and write all these... there's a funny story that we've only got some of his manuscripts. So he wrote by hand, of course, in these large sheets of paper. And during the war, he ran out of cigarette paper, so he used to use his manuscripts to roll his cigarettes. Whether it's urban, I don't know. But he had a terrible disease and some blood disease, and his legs sort of fell off or something. And then he was looked after by his wife, Philip. But because of that, that saved his life, because his colleagues, Medvedev and Voloshinov, were all sent to the Gulag, you know, yes. And they died there. Yes. But he was sent to Kazakhstan, where he became a school teacher. And so he survived the purges. And then he ended up back in St. Petersburg, finding that he'd become famous, to his surprise.
Amazing.
So he's an interesting character. So he has this idea of the unfinalizable self, because the self has what he calls no alibi in being. It's a kind of anti-metaphysical position, really, in contrast to Husserl. So Bakhtin's I, the subject of first person predicates, is constituted purely in relationship. It's purely a historically contingent entity and unfinalizable. There's no completion. There's no completion to this. There's death, of course, but there's no completion to the story of history, I suppose. And all understanding arises from the dialogical encounter. Understanding is purely historically located. The analysis of utterance, so his main concern is the notion of utterance, which he focuses on, this notion of utterance as the fundamental unit and basis of analysis for communication. And utterance is always performed and assumes preceding utterances. So any utterance you make assumes something prior to it. The speaker presupposes, this is from speech journalists, the speaker presupposes not only the existence of the language system he is using, but also the existence of preceding utterances, his own and others, which his given utterance enters into one kind of relation or another, with which, I think, I missed out with, builds on them, polemicizes with them, or simply presumes that they are already known to the listener. Sorry about these spelling errors. Any utterance is a link in a very complexly organized chain of other utterances. Well, it's kind of obvious in a way, but I don't think it was obvious before Bakhtin said it. And every utterance is filled with the echoes of other utterances. So intertextuality is terribly important. So every text responds to other texts. So a number of themes he tried to develop was what he called heteroglossia, the voices. I hear voices in everything, he says, and dialogical relations between them. He's probably famous for his study of Dostoevsky, in which he argued that Dostoevsky was a heteroglossic rather than monoglossic writer, because he gave genuine, he articulated genuine otherness within his novels, so that the characters become independent and engage with each other almost like as independent kind of characters, independent of the authorial intention, really. So each utterance also anticipates a response and is directed. It has the quality of addressivity. So each utterance has a quality of addressivity to a situation or to a person or to a group. So the social context, intonation, etc., is always very important. He wrote an interesting essay on silence. And there's different words, apparently, in Russian for silence, different kinds of silence. I'm afraid I don't know Russian. But so there's a silence between two friends, and there's a silence of the forest. Mm-hmm. And there's a silence if somebody says, well, and then there's a silence after that. What does that mean? You know, it depends on the context of its utterance. And understanding is deepened by activity of dialogue. One of his colleagues, there was a whole bunch of them, Voloshinov. Some people thought that Voloshinov was a pseudonym of Bakhtin, that Bakhtin wrote under the name Voloshinov. I don't know whether that's true, but it's probably Voloshinov is an independent person who wrote this book, Marxism and the Philosophy of Language, undoubtedly influenced by Bakhtin. Perhaps they were co-authors, but it was published under Voloshinov's name. And in that book, he coins the phrase the philosophy of the sign, and he distinguishes the philosophy of the sign from the philosophy of consciousness. And in that book, he talks about this idea of heteroglossia and the critique of Saussurean linguistics, particularly the idea of the analysis of long and the prop, the Russian formalist critique of the Russian formalist's idea of getting to the essence, if you like, of a narrative through understanding its structures. So he rejects the abstract system of Saussure and also of prop by implication, and also the romantic individualism of some of the German thinkers like Humboldt. So anyway, okay, so Bakhtin and Voloshinov hear voices and everything and dialogic relations among them. So the sign is constructed between socially organised persons and only exists in dialogue. And dialogism can help understand the wider social processes. So it's an avoidance of causal explanations, because human interaction, human communication cannot be explained in causal terms. For Bakhtin, we begin with dialogue and communication, not with a transcendental ego, as in contrast to Hirsch last week, and indeed reflecting her soul. Now, Bakhtin, is terribly important for semiotics, and his work was translated in the 60s and 70s, really, and he was particularly important to our thinker today, Julia Kristeva, who introduced Bakhtin to the Western world in that book, some of which we've read, Revolution in Poetic Language. As you may see through her interest in utterance, in signs and communication outside of the philosophy of consciousness or the philosophy of the subject. And she's influenced by psychoanalysis, structuralism and feminism. Now, in that article that some of you may have read, she makes this distinction between the semiotic and the symbolic. And the symbolic is from the medieval world, which assumes the symbolized, which are universals, which are irreducible to the symbolizer, which are the markings. So there's all that behind what she's saying. And sign is open, is an open system of generation and transformation. So she contrasts these two: the symbolic world of the medieval world, which is closed, as opposed to the semiotic modernity, if you like, which is open. And she says sign is a fundamental ideologeme of modern thought and the basic element of our discourse. So it does not refer to a single unique reality, but evokes a collection of associated images and ideas. It's very Bakhtinian. Its meaning is the result of interaction with other signs. It contains transformation. New structures are always generated and transformed. Now, I did a brief summary, very brief summary. I didn't have time to... before coming this morning, we have time to kind of outline it all. But so it's a theory. She offers a theory of language and also of the speaking subject. So in that sense, it's phenomenological. But she says the signifying process is the interaction between the semiotic and the symbolic, which of course these two realms. The semiotic refers to the web of drives and pulsations that constitute what she calls the pre-Oedipal phase of human development, as expressed in the Platonic term chora, which means receptacle or womb. We'll be going over this again in a second, so we'll just get a kind of rough overview. And signification occurs through the semiotic chora in what he calls the thetic phrase, which is derived from the word thesis, which is the adjective. I suppose you could have called it thesic rather than thetic, anyway. Thetic phrase, in which the subject can attribute difference to the undifferentiated chora. The mirror phase, which he gets from the psychoanalyst Lacan, is the first step in the constitution of objects detached from the chora, which is completed in the Oedipal phase. So she assumes a lot of psychoanalysis coming from Freud through Lacan. And this is the entry into the symbolic order in which the chora is repressed and can be perceived only as pressure and in language, which is the symbolic, as disruption. So the chora resists theorization, so semiotic theory is paradoxical. So in simple terms, then, she posits there's a semiotic realm which is pre-language, which is pre-linguistic, which is concerned for her with, which is the realm of the drives and the instincts, and this thing that she calls the chora, which is the womb or the receptacle, which is a realm of pulsating energy. She calls it pulsation or energy or power, which is pre linguistic, which is at the heart of us as subjects, as human beings and communities, I suppose. It's a bit kind of, it's French, isn't it? It's the French of the novels. It's an vital, you know, the kind of life pulsation going through everything. And so that she makes that distinction, that there's that, and then that's present. When you're a kid, there's all that is present there before you get language. And then you start growing up and you look in the mirror and you start to recognise yourself. And there's a separation from the mother. There's this the acquisition of language and the separation from the mother, which is the moving away from the chora. And then you go into the Oedipal phase, Freud's Oedipal phase, and eventually you have language and you're a subject, an independent subject, separated from the mother and alienated from the world, really, for her. And you inhabit the symbolic order from which the chora is repressed or rejected. But nevertheless, the chora, because it's a bit like Freud's unconscious, is active. It keeps asserting itself in the symbolic order, and it has to be recognised. So it's assertion, reassertion, and upsurge in the symbolic order. Yeah. So what's all this got to do with texts? Well, she says, texts, although they're within the symbolic order, within language, the revolution in poetic language is the upsurge of the chora within poetic language. It's articulated through poetic language. And you get disruption of, it causes disruption in the symbolic order through silence, meaninglessness, and so on. So texts are not so much about authorial intention, but some texts articulate this upsurge of the chora within the symbolic realm. And if you focus on authorial intention and subjectivity, you miss or you exclude the idea of you repress the chora, you repress the that energy or power which is in your essence, as it were, almost. So that's my simplistic reading of this.
But isn't really like the cultural sign system built on top of the chora, so when it had come out of the chora, so it's not like distinct from it, it must have somehow been a kind of cultural construct from the chora somehow and placed on top of it. It's not like
it doesn't disappear.
I mean I'm saying does the culture kind of contain the essence of the chora in it itself?
I think it does, because you can't get away from the chora. But I think for Kristeva, it's like a pressure on the cultural world, if you like.
But it's just that you said it was like it was repressed somehow. So, but I was just wondering what this kind of cultural system, which is distinct from the chora, was. If it must have come out of the chora in order to exist.
That's a good point. Yeah, where does that come from? That's kind of, in a sense, that's a question about the origin of language as well. Because the language, she identifies the language with the symbolic, and the chora with the semiotic, which is slightly odd in a way. And the language, which is identified with the symbolic, entails a repression of the chora, but the chora nevertheless asserts itself into the symbolic realm, regardless of its repression. So it's a bit like Freud's resistance and repression.
Is it like a kind of collective unconscious type thing?
It could be like that. She wouldn't use that language, but So Freud says there are these two mechanisms: repression. We all have an unconscious, and our conscious mind represses the unconscious. There are two forms of repression, but the unconscious asserts itself all the time, so there's resistance. So you've got repression and resistance, these two mechanisms. So I think she's getting it from that, really.
Yeah,
I wanted to ask you, why is she calling it semiotic? And does that mean that even on the level of semiotic, there is certain order? I mean, if you're talking about drives, you know, hot, cold, hungry, satiated, and, I mean, there is obviously some kind of a pre-existing
order,
there that, that organizes the symbolic in the end. It's not like it's all chaos, basically, right? This is the notion of semiotic, because it's like the pre-objectified symbolism, so to say, that exists on that. I mean, this is how this happens.
I think that's right. I'm slightly puzzled why she calls it the semiotic, but it's the semiotic because it's a signifying process. It must be a symbol. It must be a system.
Yeah, she calls it
you got your text?
I read it from the screen. not genotype and
genotype. Yes. Later on, she talks about that. So I thought we could go through this text actually. No, I don't know about you, but it's not an easy read. I don't find it. Some people think that. I mean, Paul Fides takes to Kristeva like fish in water, you know. And he's an expert in Kristeva, but unfortunately, I'm not an expert in Kristeva, but she's nevertheless worth reading and struggling with. How many texts have we got? One, two, okay. So we'll stick to a more general discussion. I'll just go through and have a look at any bits that strike me.
I haven't got it.
Well, she begins with talking about how language, modern linguistic self-assigned object, lacks a subject or tolerates only one only as a transcendental ego. And that's what she's critiquing. That language as a subject of a discourse, if you like, has the transcendental ego as a subject and defers any interrogation of its always dialectical, because translinguistic externality defers any interrogation of its externality. And she talks about two trends in current linguistics, the first of which is the arbitrary relation between the signifier and the signified. And the second trend in linguistics is that there's a positing of a subject of enunciation, which she locates in Benveniste and others, which is parallel to her soul's transcendental ego. So she starts with those two things, proposing that modern linguistics, well, in her day, had these two trends: the arbitrary relation between sign and signified, and the subject, the positing of the subject. And with regard to the first, she says, she also links that in with psychoanalysis. So that's okay. Having tried to set this up in the first few pages, to summarise briefly what we shall elucidate later, the two trends just mentioned designate two modalities of what is for us the same signifying process. We shall call the first the semiotic and the second the symbolic. So the semiotic, which is that relationship, the arbitrary relationship between the signifier and the signified, entails a sort of almost unconscious processes which are outside of conscious language, in a sense, outside of the subject of enunciation. And that's what she thinks Freud was going on about when he's talking about the unconscious and displacement and condensation and the theory of the drives or the pulsations. So that's fairly clear so far. And she talks about there are non-verbal signifying systems. Like music, for example. And then she introduces the notion of the chora. We understand the term semiotic in its Greek sense, semion, distinctive mark, trace, index, precursory sign, proof, engraved or written, sign, imprint, trace, figuration. And then she introduces this notion of the chora or the kora. Discrete quantities of energy move through the body of the subject, who is not yet constituted as such, and, in the course of this development, they are arranged according to various constraints imposed on this body, always already involved in a semiotic process, by family and social structures. In this way, the drives, which are energy charges, as well as psychical marks, articulate what we call the chora, a non-expressive totality formed by the drives and their stasis, stability in a motility that is full of movement as it is regulated. So it's a regulated bundle of energy, if you like, the chora. And it's interesting this, because she says these energies or these move through the body of the subject who is not yet constituted as such, as a subject. And in the course of this development, they're arranged according to various constraints imposed on the body, which is already always involved in a semiotic process. So you're born into a semiotic process. So that's a very interesting question. Contrast that with Merleau-Ponty, for example, that we looked at last year, who says the body is constitutes a pre-linguistic, a pre-cognitive layer of experience, which is primary, which is an existential, really, and that's prior to any semiotic system. So Kristeva has the complete opposite view, that even that is already constituted within the system of semiosis, which is Paul's view.
So is he saying that the sense of a subject was in the sense that you were a separate body and you got your subjecthood from being a separate body, and whereas she's saying no, it's not.
Yeah, your
it's not your body. It's you learn it through a linguistic process that you are a subject.
That's right.
Presuppose it.
Yeah, you learn your subjectivity through a linguistic process. But originally, you're an unconscious semiotic system, I suppose, in a sense. But you're still a semiotic. You're born within a system of semiosis.
You said that Merleau-Ponty, what he thinks that we are like chaos, but kind of emerges
the structure emerges in the chaos. There's a level beneath language. I'm not sure if he's talking like about babies or something. I don't think he means that. But there's a layer beneath or behind language and the subject, which is your deeper kind of reality. Which is not constructed semiotically, which is somehow existentially, ontologically prior. It's ontology.
Sorry, who's arguing that?
Merleau-Ponty.
I think so. Yeah.
That we looked at.
Yeah.
I think that's probably an oversimplification. Ontology is prior to semiotic system. And what constitutes that is that the way that what he calls the invisible is folded into the appears in the folds of the visible. He talks about the folds of the visible. So I think that she doesn't refer to Merleau-Ponty, but I think it implicitly she's ignoring that strand of thinking, if not rejecting it. So the chora then is, she gets on Plato, to denote an essentially mobile and extremely provisional articulation constituted by the movements and their ephemeral stasis. So any situation which passes away but is constituted energetically is the chora. And she also identifies the chora with the mother, with the womb. The womb chora is receptacle or womb, so it's also the mother. And she also, at some point in the text, identifies the mother with the phallus, which is a bit strange, really. And that it's a pure psychoanalysis. In order to achieve the symbolic, you have to undergo the castration to separate yourself from the mother. So the killing of the mother, really. And later, she really develops this in that book, Black Sun, about depression. She talks about abjection and the separation from the mother and the necessary separation from the mother in order to rediscover the original father. So, which is a bit weird because she's a feminist, isn't she?
is she seeing the core as like the kind of the femininity, the feminine element which is repressed by the masculine? Is that the feminist element?
Yeah, I think so. I think you could see it like that.
Because it being this womb.
Yeah, the mother is a female feminine dimension that you have to cut off in order to become go into the realm of the symbolic. Oh, so you're getting this from Lacan, a lot of this, because Lacan says, okay, language is identified with the phallus, and only men have got that, so only men have language, have access to language, and women are excluded from the symbolic realm.
I don't understand that.
But the kind of male civilized thing is common, isn't it?
Yeah, civilization is a predominantly male, and that's because males have control and power over the symbolic realm, which is language.
But the intuitive instinct is like the core of
something. Yeah, that's right. And that, feminine. Yeah. And Lacan says, So, but yeah, why? I mean, Kristeva's a French feminist who takes Lacan very seriously, and she develops this idea of cutting off the mother.
I was reading an article about her. I didn't understand. This was in the Guardian, and it said something about the rejection of the mother is important to the construction of modern society.
That's what she says. Yeah. Because modern society is based on an elevation of language and the symbolic realm, which she says is masculine, or Lacan says that, and we have to reject the mother in order to realise ourselves as civilised people. Okay. Yeah, so that's important. To put it crudely, you've got the mother, which is identified with the chora, which is identified with the semiotic, in contrast on the other side with the symbolic, which is identified with the masculine, and with a conscious subject. And there's been a tendency to repress the chora side. In order to elevate the conscious subject of enunciation, and we do that at our peril, at the cost of depression and alienation and all of that. Mm-hmm. So you have to reintegrate the chora back into the symbolic realm. Mm-hmm.
Did she have depression herself?
Yeah.
I just wonder what she was writing about it.
Yeah, she became she's a psychoanalyst.
What would you say that it means to reintegrate the chora into the symbolic life?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Does it mean, are those, what she calls here, acts that, engaging in acts that don't have a meaning in themselves?
Like play or something.
Mm. Is that what she means? Or, I don't know, going, just go out and scream aloud? Or what does that really mean?
I don't know the answer to that, what she really means by it, in the sense of how does that cash out in terms of cultural practices? Mm-hmm. Does it mean that you go and give all your money away or something? That's what she charges. about 500 pounds an hour or something.
Are we talking about how does this early Chora transpire with this later symbolic Bodo? Then there's another quote in her that she talks about, that the limbs with abjection, things that we fear are different, and ejected beyond the scope of the possible, tolerable, and thinkable, and we enjoy or like things that beseech us, fascinate us, horrify us.
That's right, the horror, that's right, the culture, So the zombie march in Brighton the other day or something, that would be, I suppose, an expression of the...
So like the whole aesthetics of the ugly and all these kind of things.
That's right, the aesthetics of the ugly, all that. She gets all that from Bakhtin, who's concerned with the Saturnalia and the grotesque. He's interested in the grotesque. That's right, that's interesting,
So it's somehow like dipping into the anti-structure somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, to achieve, I guess, some kind of balance.
Dissociation, trance states and stuff like that.
Indeed. Yeah.
But how would you apply that then to text?
Exactly, this is my question here. What's all this going to do?
I must say I didn't get to the very end.
How do you introduce Cora into the text?
Yes.
Which is symbolic.
My question is, what is the Cora? What has the Cora to do with the notion of text? Why are we reading this?
Yes.
Is it relevant? How does this affect your critical edition? Is it?
You start writing like senseless words.
Yes.
Free association.
Dada is poetry.
Right? Well, that's right.
Yeah.
Dada is poetry, but the eruption of the Cora is symbolic.
Yeah, wouldn't that be?
Yes. Perhaps it's just silences.
The different thing, like what we talked about, one of the different things that she does is in her work, she does like normal authorship will just have normal writing on it, but she writes how she's thinking on those certain feelings or processes along the side of it that we spoke about.
That's
last
right.
So it doesn't have to. So she writes about Christianity and Mary, but then she writes about, I think, I don't know if it's her own experiences of motherhood along the side.
That's right. A commentary, if you like.
So it doesn't have to follow a similar pattern.
Yeah, like, something like that. You know, she's got the text and then she has a commentary on the side here. It's a bit like Judaism, where you have the Torah, the text, and you have commentaries written all around it, and she follows in that kind of practice. So, very much semiotician.
And maybe that the religious text does it through, like, they tend to have a kind of multivocal, like, mythological kind of element to them, which goes against the kind of linear, univocal text of, I guess, civilization.
Yes.
And so it may step towards the Chora in some way.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's right. Also, ritual, I suspect, steps towards the Chora and so on. So the idea, I think it's important, your question about text, I think it's important because texts are written in language, and texts articulate real things for human, articulate human reality. And a strong part of human reality, if she is right, is this idea that there are processes in our lives that are outside of consciousness and which influence our consciousness, and that there are some practices and some processes which can take us into those worlds for our edification and well-being, and that you have to come to terms with these other kind of dimensions of life. So I suspect that in answer to that question that Plivoye posed, she might well say, she might well think that there are practices of ritual, for example, or shamanic practices that can take you into the realms, kind of to face up to the abjection and the rejection of the mother and the deconstruction of the self, and the self's reconstitution, and that these things can be articulated through text.
But with regard to text, does that really mean the upsurge of reflexivity in writing, then? You know, that when you are kind of writing, you are trying to include more yourself in the writing?
She would agree with that, definitely.
Yeah, so that's like part of this whole postmodern...
Life writing, that's part of the whole postmodern thing. And postmodern ethnography, you know, when you write yourself into the text. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, isn't it? There's a whole parallel. I mean, poetry that reflects that too. You get a reflexivity in poetry, a turn away from the Eliots and all that towards subjectivity, like I don't know, Lowell's Life Studies or something. And also the fragmentation, the notion of the rejection of the of a centralized subject or author, so you get a fragmentation of the text itself. So kind of William Burroughs and all these people. So William Burroughs practices the cut-up method. So he writes The Naked Lunch, chucks it up in the air, and gathers it together again, publishes it like that. That's an exaggeration, but. So that to disrupt all the time, to disrupt the notion of a coherent subject of awareness, which in Chris Davis' term is an eruption of the chora into discourse. Well, have another look at. I think she's worth reading. I mean, in a way, you could read it like poetry. That's how I approach these things. You read it like poetry. But if you get a rough structure out of it, I think it's and then you reread it in the light of that structure. It makes more sense for you.
I continuously felt like I needed to know Lacan better than I do.
Yeah.
To understand what she's saying.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Well, Lacan's almost unreadable. I find that you can read summaries.
C'est en français.
But and Freud, I mean, Freud's good fun. He's easy. You can understand the clarity to Freud's writing.
But I'd read some of her things on intertextuality before, which I thought was a lot easier than this.
Yeah. This is her first kind of impacted book. Yeah, we could read something on intertextuality. I mean, she's just written something called Forgiveness. Which is really readable, you know, this is very easy to read. But assumes all of this work.
She writes novels too now.
Does she write novels? I didn't know that.
Religious mystery novels.
Does she really? Good as. Like Roberto Eco.
You read something?
Have I?
Yeah.
No. I found it this is interesting. Confusing enough, I thought the novel might.
She writes
religious mystery novels.
Religious mystery.
Considering that she's a. Actually, a materialist philosopher.
But who is it? You were saying she's been invited to the Vatican.
It's actually today.
Yeah.
The SCC conference. That she's one of the speakers at that.
Wow.
It's a meeting of religious leaders.
Oh. Wow.
Sort of called by the Pope. And she was invited as one of the. I think there's only four non-religious leaders invited.
And she was one of them.
Oh. And it's actually today.
Well, yeah. So the Pope, he's probably read her, he's probably likes her.
No,
I
wouldn't be surprised.
He's an intellectual, isn't he? He's a phenomenologist. I think he's the wrong kind of phenomenologist. Well, thanks everyone. So the next time we'll look at reader reception, I think.